All right, y'all, welcome to the show. Oops, I better hit go on this and that. How are you guys doing? Hope you had a good weekend. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org is my website. LRN.FM is where my show is broadcasting out of. That's the Liberty Radio Network, of course. Got a good show lined up for you today. I better make sure to write down what it all is so I don't forget. First up, we're going to have John Pfeffer on to talk about Eastern Europe and NATO and Russia and all that cool stuff. And then Will Grigg on the cops. Man, now, here's the thing about Will Grigg. Boy, is he a great writer. And boy, does he have a nose for what cops are doing wrong. My God, man. I would think that he was making this stuff up. It's like he's a talented, short story writer who's constantly coming up with, look at what scum the cops are. It is unbelievable. Unbelievable. And yet, no, it's all true. You follow the links. It's to the local news stories and what have you. You go double and triple check his implications and the way, he explains what's going on and see. I think you'll find honesty and clarity. It's just amazing. It is. I read Will Grigg's blog, and, you know, I've always hated cops since I was 11 years old or something. Because I'm a skateboarder, and they've always hated me since I was 11 years old. So, you know, the feeling became mutual immediately. I've always hated him. I watched him burn the Branch Davidians to death, 100 miles from my door. I know who these guys are and how bad they are, and yet I read Will Grigg's blog and I just think to myself, my God, man, are you kidding me? How in the world? It's not the level of the crime, it's how blatant they are about it. The way they just strut around like, old mobsters or something. Yeah, what are you gonna do about it? That's what I thought, basically. That's the law. Like Boss Hogg on the Dukes of Hazzard. In fact, I wonder if that's part of why I'm such an anarchist. Because my first understanding of the law was what this pig says. I am the law, he would say. And it was true. There was nothing, written down and agreed upon by free men about it. No, sir. All right, well, whatever. Will Grigg is going to be on to talk about all the boss hogs among us. Good. And Ray McGovern, again, I interviewed him Friday, I interviewed him Saturday, I played it on the show Sunday, and now I'm going to have him on the show again today, but on another brand new topic. A different topic. And that topic is the USS Liberty and the Israeli attack on the USS Liberty. And the thing about that is that, what a strange thing. The thing about that is Ray knows all about it. Why? He was in the CIA back then. And the other thing about that is there's a brand new documentary ran on Al Jazeera over the weekend. It'll be running numerous times. It's already up on YouTube. If you look at my Twitter feed, you can find it. I should have blogged it. Maybe I'll get around to blogging on my website. I didn't think the link would last this long. I don't believe it's an official Al Jazeera link, but so far, they're letting it stand. They're on YouTube. And, boys, it's something else. And they claim, and I don't know the whole history of this, but they claim to have exclusive recordings of the Israeli radio transmissions from that day. I don't speak Hebrew one bit. So I can't verify the translations, but I sure hadn't heard anything disputing the translations of it. In fact, I think I'll play the clips for you because it won't take that long. We'll do that in the next segment. And if any of you out there speak Hebrew and you can tweet me or email me or join up the chat room and verify that what's being said is, more or less the Al Jazeera subtitles, I guess that'd be helpful, but I don't think it's really a concern, honestly. They have this audio. They have the subtitles. Surely Al Jazeera can find people who can translate Hebrew well. And I sure heard the word American in there a few times, and that's all I need to know, man. Unless, and I'll have Ray McGovern, I guess, verify the timeline here. But I don't think that there's anything controversial about the legitimacy of the facts here, only that they're being stated. And I didn't get to finish the documentary, honestly, but I left off at the part where it's all the public relations and that kind of thing. I'll finish the watching the documentary after the show today if I have a chance, but I did get to see, I don't know, two-thirds of it. So I saw, you know, all the attack, and I have the sound bites from the overheard Israelis. And I'll go ahead and ruin it for you. And you may have read the book. I have James Scott's book, but I have not read it yet. It's on my pile of, yeah, right, one day when I have a year off of work to just sit and read for fun, I'll catch up to pile. It's like my fantasy. I'll get to read all these books. Anyway, you may be very familiar with the story, but the story is that here's the fighter jets and air traffic control talking about, oh, yeah, it's an American ship, all right, go ahead and bomb it. And they kept bombing it and bombing it and bombing it and attacking it and strafing it and napalming it. And then the pilot says, all right, enough of this. We ought to let the Navy have their share. So, and then they discuss the identity of the American, of the boat as an American boat again. You're telling me this is an American ship, right? Yep. All right, well, we're going to go ahead and go now. Well, here come the torpedo boats. And then the torpedo boats attack them for another half hour or 45 minutes or whatever it is. After there's just, hey, man, I heard the word American over and over. That's all I need to know. I don't need to speak Hebrew. All I need to know is no one's really challenging the authenticity of this recording. No one is saying, you fabricated that in a sound studio somewhere. I don't see Netanyahu crying about it today in Haaretz or the New York Times that anybody's faked this. They would rather the whole issue go away. And of course, nobody's going to use faked, I don't know how they got this exclusive, but nobody's going to use faked evidence in a thing like this. So anyway, I'm sorry that, really, the only reason I'm talking about the Hebrew aspect is it's unfortunate that I have the clips, but I can't really understand them, and I can't guarantee personally what they say. But I'll play them for you anyway. You can have them recorded yourself then, if you want to clip them out and save them for later. And I'm sure there will be plenty of checks and balances out there in, you know, I don't know, for example, on Twitter, on other places of, you know, whether anybody is claiming that there's any dispute here. In fact, I'm sure if there was any dispute about the translations, it would be all over Twitter this morning. Instead, it's not. And anyway, so Ray McGovern, he's still got a chip on his shoulder about the Israeli attack on the USS Liberty. And good. So I'm going to interview him about that again today. I have quite a few times in the past. And I've interviewed Liberty survivors in the past as well. I just didn't do the legwork this morning to try to get them on. But if you go to scotthorton.org and search USS Liberty, you'll find, I believe, three different interviews with USS Liberty survivors in the past, and plus many with Ray and others, too. I think I've interviewed Eric Margulies about it and a few others. This new Al Jazeera thing, they claim to have exclusive new evidence. And I will get into playing those clips for you with minimal comment between them there, I hope, at the end of the show. That way you'll have them for your records later anyway. And cool. And then also one more thing about this, and I didn't get to see too much of this, but they have Bobby Ray Inman, who was the head of the NSA at the time, I believe. He had a lot of different bureaucrat jobs for the empire back then. But I believe at the time that this happened... No, I guess he became the head of NSA later. I don't know. I'll ask Ray. But they got him on the record talking here. And I only saw the very beginning of the clips of his interview. And he's only talking politics in there. But so I'll ask Ray about, you know, what we learned from this pretty exclusive interview of him. Highest level guy to talk about this on the record, I guess, since, I don't know, a long time since the original cover-up. Back in a sec. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still. If you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders, quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, Al Scott here. If you've got a band, a business, a cause, or campaign, and you need stickers to help promote, check out thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. They digitally print with solvent ink, so you get the photo quality results of digital with the strength and durability of old-style screen printing. I'm sure glad I sold thebumpersticker.com to Rick back when. He's made a hell of a great company out of it, and there are thousands of satisfied customers who agree with me, too. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. So let's take a listen to some of these clips. If I can get the VLC player to open up for me. I thank you, VLC player. Nice to see you. All right. And let's start with USS Liberty number one. I'll just tell you what I've labeled them. This is USS Liberty number one ID. Alright, so there's a little bit of Al Jazeera music there in the background for their intellectual proprietaries, whatever. Then you hear a lady going, blah, 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 blah. All the way through all of these clips, you'll hear the lady going, blah, 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 blah. Apparently, she's just counting. And that's, you know, part of their background crap. So try to listen around the lady talking. She's not what's important. You can hear in that clip, there's two voices. Apparently, according to the subtitles, the pilot is saying, hey, what the hell? And the air traffic control is answering back that, yes, it's an American ship. Here's that clip one more time. All right. And so now, number two is the pilot saying to air traffic control, hey, man, that's an American ship? And air traffic control responds, no comment. Alright. So, that's number two there. Where, yeah, they know they're attacking an American ship. No comment, of course, means, man, I know this is being recorded. And I'm worried about being on the record saying, hell yeah, I know it's an American ship. So I'll just respond, no comment. Hey, is there any other explanation for that? No, there's not. Okay, now the next one. The translation is, does he screw her? That's the code word for, you know, what should I bomb him with next? I guess something close to that. And then the answer is, he goes down on her with napalm. And this is the way the Israelis pass their orders back and forth. In this case of slaughtering Americans, burning them to death with jelly gasoline. All right, there's the order to napalm the Americans. And then the next one will be the, I believe it's the pilot recommending that, well, I think I want to go ahead and break off my attack now. We have enough planes in the air. And then I think that maybe the control says we have enough planes. And then the pilot says, well, let's go ahead and let the Navy come in and get their shots. You know, it's all about sharing the target with the other service, the way he says it anyway. All right. And I think there's just two more now. ID again. This is he asked for another confirmation that it's Americans, and when he's told plainly that yes, it is an American ship, then at that point they break off the air attack. But then send in the torpedo boats. And then in this one, this is the last clip here of the supposed exclusive clips that Al Jazeera has now of the Israeli radio communications as they were attacking the USS Liberty in 1967. It was June the 8th, I think it was. Sorry, I might be wrong. We are now pumping the ship with torpedoes, he says. All right. So, again, I apologize. I'm playing clips for you in Hebrew, but I want you to have them. You can either, you know, record this, or at least, obviously, you know, you can go to my website, scotthorton.org, and you'll be able to get the whole show archives there. In fact, I might tack that on to the end of this Ray McGovern interview. So if people want, they can have those clips. And then I hope that there's some kind of debate about the authenticity of the translation, of the authenticity of the clips themselves, so that it can be proven. I don't think there's any reason to doubt the translations or the authenticity in either case. But I hope that there's a fight about it so that it's really proven and reinforced what this really says. But anyway, so now we all have it for our records anyway. There they are in Hebrew, according to, again, maybe you're tuning in late, you missed out. We're talking about the new Al Jazeera documentary about the attack on the USS Liberty in 1967. It's called The Day Israel Attacked America. And I don't know, I actually read, they had a pretty, 800-word article or something, basically just introducing the documentary a day or two before it aired. And I do not believe that they talk about, you know, in any way kind of intimate where they got this audio. Maybe they got it from the Americans. In fact, that'll be a good question for Ray, is, are these the NSA intercepts that have been leaked to Al Jazeera here? Very interesting stuff. Let's see. Write that down so I don't forget. Source for new audio. And then I did not make clips out of all the newsworthy and groundbreaking and incredibly important things that the people interviewed for the documentary say. Just watch the documentary. I'm not going to poach the whole damn thing from them for you. It's The Day Israel Attacked America. And, yeah, it's really worth watching. And, you know, come on. We already know the story, most of us. If you don't, you might be amazed, but it's just little tidbits of things. And again, maybe some of you already knew this or that, but, I didn't realize, for example, that, you know, they have their choice of different flags that they fly. I mean, all of them American flags, but different, you know, individual actual ones. And some of them of different sizes. And that day, they had the jumbo, extra, extra large American flag flying. For, I guess, just because it was a windy day and they love America so damn much, or whatever. You could have seen that Stars and Stripes for miles and miles. Tell me it's an accident. Anyway. All right, that's it for this segment. Back in just a minute with John Pfeffer from Foreign Policy and Focus on Eastern Europe. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. I want to tell you about this great new book, Livin' La Vida Baroka, American Culture in an Age of Imperial Orthodoxies by Thomas Harrington. While he comes from the left, Harrington has little time for much of what is passed off under that label today. Like us libertarians, he puts peace and freedom first. The book's got great essays on American fascism, empire, the Israeli occupation, the left and Obama, liberalism in the state, and some interesting lessons from the history of Imperial Spain. Livin' La Vida Baroka by Thomas Harrington. Check it out at scotthorton.org/books or scotthorton.org/Amazon.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you.
All right, y'all. Welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. Yes, I lopped the third hour off of the show. Gone back to 2 hours, at least for now. 2 hours a day. I'm going to still try to do 3 interviews a day for you guys if I can, but I got just too much other work to do. So today's first guest, it's our friend John Pfeffer from Foreign Policy in Focus, FPIF.org. And he's got this article, NATO Rebellion in the Ranks. Welcome back to the show, John. How are you?
Fine. Thanks for having me on the show again, Scott.
Very happy to have you back on. Now, so here's the thing. You got this wannabe Stalin or wannabe Hitler or something like that, this Vladimir Putin, this long-time-serving autocrat, right-wing, Ronchevist, something-something, whatever that means. And he's going to take over all of Europe again. And so America, the guarantor of global collective security, has rallied the countries of Eastern Europe together. And they have, you know, obviously they see it America's way. And so have all fallen in lockstep behind America's renewed attempt to contain and isolate and sanction the would-be new Soviet Union. And so what's the problem?
Well, Eastern Europe doesn't quite see it that way. I mean, they are a narrow band of countries between Western Europe and the former Soviet Union. They're in a pretty vulnerable position there, and they are not happy about the possibility of a new Cold War developing. And so they have pushed back against some of the sanctions that the United States and Europe have proposed and have followed through with on Russia, and they are not entirely enthusiastic about NATO pushing hard to the east. So that's a dilemma we're dealing with right now. The United States is not so happy about the ambivalence that Eastern European countries have been showing.
Well, what do we require of them?
Well, it depends. Number one, we're looking for strong support for economic sanctions against Russia. But for a lot of countries, and the Czech Republic, Slovakia, Hungary, Bulgaria, these countries in part depend on economic trade with Russia. They also have great dependency on energy coming from the former Soviet Union, from Russia. And they're also concerned that a freezing of economic relations between the West and the East would be a devastating blow on their own economies, since they depend very much on being in this pivotal spot between East and West. So that's one thing, the economic sanctions. The other thing is the military question. And, you know, President Obama was in Estonia, one of the Baltic countries up the north, recently, and he basically was encouraging the Baltic countries and Eastern Europe more generally to help Ukraine, basically Kiev, the government in Kiev, either by providing economic assistance or some military assistance. And there is some ambivalence there, too. I mean, even Poland. Poland has been perhaps the greatest supporter of Ukraine and one of the most suspicious of Vladimir Putin's motives. But even Poland has said, well, look, you know, we really should be focusing a little bit more on our security. Now, that doesn't mean that Poland is, you know, abandoning NATO. In fact, the new Polish Prime Minister, Ewa Kopacz, has renewed calls for NATO to station troops in Poland. And Poland just recently has reoriented its own army away from its western border and towards its eastern border. But still, at the same time, Ewa Kopacz, the new Prime Minister, said, well, you know, we really are not capable by ourselves of taking on Russia, and we have to make sure that we put Polish security first. So that, I think, has put a damper a little bit on Poland's eagerness, shall we say, mm-hmm. to support Ukraine overwhelmingly with economic and military assistance.
Yeah. Well, you know, this isn't really the direction I wanted to go here, but I have to comment on that and ask you about that. It seems like all over the place we hear references to what it would take for who or what combination of who's to take on Russia. When Russia, I thought by definition, is unattackable or even, you know, no one can fight a war with that. If Poland was invaded by Russia, their leader's real only priority would be to surrender quickly so that the Russians don't kill all of them with hydrogen bombs. And so that sucks for them. It sucks to be from Poland and dominated by your giant hydrogen bomb wielding neighbor, the Russians or whatever. But anyone would rather surrender than have their nation completely wiped off the face of the planet with H-bombs. So, you know, Poland and what army? America, Britain, France, Germany, and everybody else are going to fight a nuclear war against Russia to keep them out of Poland? I don't think so. I think, I mean, in the Reagan years, the line, as Pat Buchanan always says, in the Reagan years, the line was Berlin, you know, West Berlin and the Elbe River. But now you want the line to be literally like, you know, Latvia or Poland? It's crazy.
Well, you know, regardless of what you or I prefer, these countries are now in NATO. So that means there is a security guarantee. In other words, if Russia were to attack Poland, they would invoke the NATO charter and everybody would come to the defense of Poland. But I don't, frankly,
is that really guaranteed, do you think? Or might they just say, forget you? I mean, really, are we going to trade all our states' biggest cities for them, for Warsaw?
Well, I don't actually want to put it to a test. And I don't think Russia is willing to put it to a test either. I mean, Russia doesn't have any territorial interests in Poland at the moment. It doesn't have any territorial interests in any of the Eastern European countries. Russia has been pretty narrowly concerned in what it calls the near abroad, and that includes, you know, this revived idea of Novorossiya, which includes parts of Ukraine. Russia has been narrowly focused on the areas around its borders where large numbers of Russians live. In some cases, you know, the countries where large numbers of Russians live have acted preemptively. For instance, Kazakhstan. Kazakhstan kind of went out of its way to basically say, we're guaranteeing the language and cultural rights of our ethnic Russians within Kazakhstan's borders. And so Russia kind of doesn't have that card to play. Can't say it's coming to the defense of Russians in Kazakhstan because there's nothing to defend. The issue, of course, right now is Ukraine and the ethnic Russians or Russian speakers in the eastern part of Ukraine. But it's not just Ukraine. There is, of course, the Baltics. It would probably be the more likely place where there might be a conflict because there are large numbers of Russians who live in Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia. So that, I think, is perhaps the place where this nuclear scenario might occur. Although, again, you know, I don't think Russia is interested in taking on the West or NATO per se. Again, it has had relatively narrow security interests in mind.
Yeah, well, you know, here's the thing about that. That would make sense if there was really such a thing as the Russian state, but really it is just humans over there. And you look at Putin, I mean, he is a politician, and that's, I mean, you can't get worse than that. So it seems like any politician, any other politician in his same position, provided they had the ability, would be expansionist and try to seek as much power as they possibly could, right? That's what the American politicians do all day. So what's keeping him from wanting to be expansionist? Like you say, he's not even interested in it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good question. And, you know, Putin is old enough to know that the Russian state and previously the Soviet state expanded at its own risk, at its own peril. In other words, it would only get territory successfully or manage territory successfully if it could actually control that territory. The war in Afghanistan was a devastating impact on kind of the Russian psyche, the Soviet psyche, demonstrated that in some sense Russians could not control an area where there wasn't a large Russian-speaking population. In other words,
right, hold it right there, John. Sorry, we got to take this break. We'll be right back with John Pfeffer, FPIF.org.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, all, Scott here for Whole Food Multicomplete at WholeFoodComplete.com. Whole Food Multicomplete is an entire supplement program in one bottle, containing 100% RDA of vitamins and minerals, plus live probiotics, digestive enzymes, antioxidant herbs, energy nutrients, and more. It's made in America using real foods and live probiotics, no chemical synthetics. It's soy-free, gluten-free, and independently tested and verified. They're so sure you'll love it, they're taking 20% off your first order with coupon code Scott Horton. Satisfaction is guaranteed at WholeFoodComplete.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And I'm talking with John Pfeffer from Foreign Policy and Focus. We're talking about, well, Ukraine, but really America, Russia, NATO, and everybody stuck in between us. And so I was kind of playing dumb there and saying, well, why wouldn't Putin want to take over all of Europe? After all, Russia used to rule Eastern Europe for 50, 60, 70 years there. Whatever. So anyway, so he said, yeah, because they can't. That's why not. And because Putin ain't stupid. So, okay, that makes a lot of sense. But so is the Washington Post editorial board stupid, or are they just liars? Because they keep telling me that I have to be afraid because Russia's coming for me, and that everything we got to do in Eastern Europe is to contain their menace, just like the old days.
Well, I think what the Washington Post is up to, at least these opinion columnists and Applebaum and David, and I don't remember the other guy's name, but
Jackson
pretty
Deal.
Consistent. Yes, Jackson Deal, exactly. They are interested in stiffening the backbone of Eastern Europeans. In other words, they perceive that there's some wavering on the eastern edge of NATO. And they want to say, hey, look, this is not acceptable. The United States basically is not going to tolerate this kind of ambivalence. It's fine for you guys to mess around with your own economies and even your own politics. And certainly Hungary is an example of a country that has moved in the direction of illiberalism, as Viktor Orban has called it. But it's quite another thing for you guys to team up with Russia, as Hungary has been doing. And another as well for Czech Republic, Slovakia, Poland, and Romania, and Bulgaria, to show some kind of hesitancy when it comes to applying economic sanctions or supporting NATO's efforts on the Eastern Front. So I think that's their issue. It's not a question so much of whether they're stupid or whether they're lying. It's really a question of how they massage the news, which is essentially what a columnist is designed to do.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's just that everything that they write over there at the Washington Post pretty much is about how everybody's a threat, and that's why our aggressive behavior is justified, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So
exactly.
after a long-standing pattern, I guess, yeah, maybe they're all strung out on crank and just absolutely paranoid out of their minds, or maybe they're dishonest, or maybe they just don't care what the truth is. I'm not sure exactly how it works. But I've known people before who were strung out on crank and who were as paranoid as Ann Applebaum, for example.
I think there is a low-level degree of paranoia that you would find at the Washington Post. And, you know, it's been overtaken by other events. I mean, certainly the Islamic State has been, you know, the force that has replaced Vladimir Putin as the general source of paranoia for the American foreign policy establishment. And for the general public, I suspect it would be Ebola. And so Putin has kind of been reduced in his stature as a major threat. But for the folks in Europe, it's another matter because they're perhaps less focused on what's going on in Syria, and they haven't been dealing with Ebola so much. And so the issue of Ukraine is still front and center. It's still the issue for NATO at the moment. So both Jackson Deal and Applebaum have focused a great deal in Europe. They are Atlanticists. They believe that the U.S.-European relationship, the NATO relationship, is still the kind of cornerstone of American foreign policy. So for them, you know, NATO lives and dies, frankly, by the threat that Russia poses. If Russia no longer poses a threat, if, for instance, Putin were replaced tomorrow by someone like Yeltsin, someone who had basically the same foreign policy, but was much more conciliatory toward the United States, then NATO again would have this kind of crisis, this existential crisis, wouldn't know quite what to do with itself other than out-of-area operations like Afghanistan, Northern Africa. But its purpose enshrined in its charter is Europe and the borders of Europe. So if you remove the threat from the borders of Europe, then NATO starts to wander.
And by the way, when Kerry and Lavrov had that meeting recently, did that signal that what did that signal? Anything?
Well, not a great deal. I mean, obviously, you know, the Obama administration would very much like to get some kind of an agreement with Russia to settle the Ukraine issue. And it is, as several commentators have pointed out, not a terribly difficult issue to settle. If you kind of establish some kind of autonomy for the folks in eastern Ukraine. But increasingly that has not been something either Moscow or Washington have been able to negotiate. So that meeting between Kerry and Lavrov basically hasn't gone anywhere. Mm-hmm. So that's the challenge at the moment for Washington, to the extent that it's paying any attention to Ukraine. And meanwhile, on the ground in Ukraine, I mean, the folks in eastern Ukraine held an election. Folks in western section of Ukraine also had their election. And the situation on the ground has become more polarized because the folks in the east were not voting in the elections in the west. More pro-European, shall we say, factions won in the kind of national Ukrainian election, and we have more separatist-oriented folks coming out of one candidate elections in the east. So, unfortunately, these elections have divided the country even more. So it's become a little bit more difficult to negotiate that solution.
Mm. Well, and there's still people being killed there.
That's correct. Even though there are so-called ceasefires on the ground, fighting still takes place. I think both sides are trying to assess whether it's actually feasible to have a quote-unquote military solution, when in fact, of course, not feasible to have a military solution. It's basically a deadlock in terms of the balance of forces. Yeah. So it's just a question of when to get these folks to the table, when to negotiate some kind of solution. Ukraine, the government in Kiev, is reluctant to see the country partitioned, and understandably so. Mm-hmm. The forces in eastern Ukraine, well, it's a toss-up between folks on the ground who basically are somewhat scared of Kiev and want to make sure that their lifestyle is protected, and the fighters, some of whom are actually just imported from Russia and have an entirely different perspective. So it's a tough situation to negotiate.
Yeah. Well, but now I want to go back to something you said there about how, well, I forget your exact words, but something along the lines of the power on the ground has already sort of sorted itself out. We're really just waiting for the negotiation. So if I understand you right, you're referring to the fact that the Russian-backed militias there in the east, they basically stopped the government's attempt to drive them out of their positions in those eastern towns, and they drove the government back, and the government quit trying, at least for now, at that point, and basically has had to recognize some level of autonomy. Now it's just a matter of fine-tuning the level of autonomy, and if they can't, it'll be full secession. Is that what you're saying?
Basically. I mean, we're heading into winter, and there's not going to be any military attempts, I think, during the winter to for one side or the other to gain the upper hand. But you're absolutely correct that the government really thought over the summer that it could basically defeat the rebels, and they would push back basically because the rebels have some hardware support from Russia. So there is a deadlock on the ground. And, you know, the question really is whether the rebel forces in the east will accept something short of secession. And, you know, that really depends. I mean, I do think there are some, shall we say, sensible folks in the east who are willing to come to a political negotiation. But there are others who, frankly, want to see the end of Ukraine. And so this is simply a kind of strategy that they're using, not so much for secession. I mean, ruling this area of eastern Ukraine is not within their capabilities, frankly. They're simply seeing it as a tool to dislodge folks from Kiev and bring the whole country down. And that obviously is a non-negotiable position. So it's really a question of isolating those folks and somehow bringing the compromising faction to the table and getting some kind of solution.
All right. Well, good luck. When I'm president, you'll be Secretary of State. Thanks, John.
Thank you, Scott.
Appreciate it. All right, that's John Pfeffer, y'all. FPIF.org. NATO. Rebellion in the ranks? Right back. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium. And they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. It's the Will Grigg Interview Show, where I, your host, Scott Horton, interviews Will Grigg. I interview Will Grigg. There's no S belongs on there. Anyway, he's got the eloquence. I just, you know, have the record button. Hey, Will, tell me about these corrupt cops in Utah. I read your blog today, freedominourtime.blogspot.com. freedominourtime.blogspot.com, and I almost couldn't believe my eyeballs when I was reading. And
I know.
I read everything you write, and so that's really saying something. Go ahead and blow them all away with this thing.
Well, this is a case that defies credulity for anybody who's not dutifully following the antic parade of corruption that is law enforcement in the American Soyuz. In Utah, as in most other states, there's an organization called the Fraternal Order of Police, which operates in most states like a police union. There's an FOP here in Idaho. It doesn't call itself a union, but in Utah they call themselves a union. They have got it in for Salt Lake County District Attorney Sim Gill because, in spite of the fact that he's a prosecutor, he seems to be hostage to the idea that the law applies to everybody equally, including police officers, which is why earlier this year he made an admirable but unsuccessful attempt to prosecute a former West Valley City narcotics detective by the name of Sean Coley, I believe it's pronounced Cowley, actually, who a couple of years ago shot and killed Danielle Willard. She was a 21- or 22-year-old woman in the parking lot outside of an apartment complex in West Valley City during a botched drug investigation. She was suspected of possessing heroin. No heroin was found in her possession. She was approached by two men she didn't recognize, and she tried to leave the parking lot because within the couple of days leading up to this incident, she had been attacked in her home by people who were involved in drug trafficking. She'd gone to Utah, interestingly, from Washington State in order to seek treatment for her drug addiction. And she had contacted the police a couple of days before the shooting in November 2012 because her home had been broken into and she's being threatened. So she was approached by these two men who may or may not have been identified as police officers. They had their guns drawn. And she tried to leave the parking lot. And as she fled, she was shot from behind and to her left by Detective Cowley. And over the course of a couple of years, an investigation was made into the West Valley City Police Department that, predictably enough, turned up evidence of abundant corruption within its narcotics investigation unit, which has been shut down. And Sim Gill conducted that investigation. And in the course of doing so, he threw out dozens of cases that had been made on the basis of unreliable evidence or perjury, or in which there was pretty compelling evidence of misconduct by the police officers. And earlier this year, he ruled that the shooting, actually was July of last year, July of 2013, if memory serves, he ruled that the shooting of Daniel Willett was unjustified. And then this year, there was a preliminary hearing on manslaughter charges that were filed against Sean Cowley. This is one of the few times in the history of Utah that a police officer has actually faced the prospect of prosecution for an on-duty killing that was manifestly unnecessary. And the preliminary hearing resulted in the charge being dismissed because, as is the case in most jurisdictions, there's enormous deference granted to police in the exercise of lethal force in circumstances that normal citizens would not be permitted to. And this is particularly interesting because one of the people who intervened on behalf of Detective Cowley is a former federal judge by the name of Paul Cassell, who is a rampaging jihadist in the cause of capital punishment and somebody who's tried to get the exclusionary rule overturned. He wants to do away with Miranda. But he insisted that it was appropriate to grant to Officer Cowley something like an enhanced Miranda status through what's called the Garrity Guarantee for police officers, and that his special privileged version of Miranda had been violated, supposedly, by the Salt Lake County District Attorney, Sim Gill. And so he managed to persuade a federal judge, actually, forgive me, a district judge in the state of Utah, to dismiss the charges. And while this was going on, the Fraternal Order of Police in Utah were filing bar complaints against Sim Gill and looking for a candidate they could support to run against him. And they found in his office a deputy DA by the name of Nelson, who's a Republican, unlike Gill, who's a Democrat, and he's running against Sim Gill, his boss, in tomorrow's election for the county district attorney's office. And so all this is a necessary backdrop to what happened on October 22nd, when a 72-year-old man by the name of Robert Warren was shot in the face on the front door of his home in West Valley City. The chief suspect is an identified gang member by the name of Raymond Marquina, and he was aided by three people who are considered to be accomplices. So they were very quickly arrested because they were very well known to the authorities. The three accomplices were charged. One of them was sent back to prison on a parole violation, so they're all either in custody of the West Valley Police Department, actually the Salt Lake County Sheriff's Office, or they're in custody in the prison system there. But a week after the shooting, Marquina was inexplicably let go. And the reason that was given initially by Sheriff Winder in Salt Lake County and by the West Valley City Police Department was that there was a mistake in the evidence, that they hadn't provided sufficient evidence in order to hold Marquina and have him indicted for the charge of attempted murder and felonious discharge of a weapon. So on October 29th, the Fraternal Order of Police issued a press release accusing Sim Gill of being responsible for this mistake that was made by the police in providing the evidence to the prosecutor's office, and claiming that he was covering up his mistake that he made in allowing this would-be murderer to be set free. But the problem here, first of all, is that in the DA's office, the head of the Violent Crimes Unit is the person who's running against him as the potential DA. His political rival, in other words, is the guy upon whose desk this case would have landed, first of all, because he's the head of the Violent Felony Unit, and he's also an amply decorated veteran prosecutor of street gangs. He's got a whole wall full of plaudits and awards and plaques that he's received for his service as a gang investigator. That's the first problem. He would have actually been routed through the office of the guy that the Fraternal Order of Police is supporting there to replace Sim Gill. The second problem here, of course, is that the DA, like any other prosecutor, can't simply hold somebody if the evidence is insufficient because of this nasty little provision in the Constitution, frequently ignored but very important, called the habeas corpus guarantee. If you can't charge a guy with a crime, you have to let him go within a certain limited time frame. Typically in Utah, it's 48 hours. In this case, Marquina was held for a week. But irrespective of the fact that there's no reason to believe that Sim Gill would do something so consummately stupid as to release a veteran gangbanger and would-be murderer on the streets a few days before an election, and the fact that this is something that would have gone through the office of his subordinate political rival, and the fact that the police screwed up, the Fraternal Order Police managed to capture the news cycle last Thursday and last Friday by putting into the information bloodstream the idea that Sim Gill, who is an inveterate cop hater, and he had the lack of wisdom and foresight to arrange to be born in India rather than in Utah. That's a very important part of this equation, Scott, He's being painted as somebody who is a foreign-born usurper, who is an inveterate top-hater because of the misfortune he had of being brought up as a young child in India. The former head of the Republican Party in Utah, as a matter of fact, actually said that he's not qualified to be the DA because he grew up in India rather than in America, and that means that he's got a negative perception of police on the basis of the way that cops behave in India. The cops in India, of course, like any place else, are instruments of violence, and they're clothed in privilege. But the cops in Utah, of course, are the primary concern of the public here, and there's a large and understandably growing movement on the part of people who are the families of police victims to seek accountability, and Sim Gill has been somewhat sympathetic in defiance of his political connections and all reasonable expectations we have for somebody who's part of that cohort. He's actually been listening to people who've seen their family members beaten or tased or shot or otherwise mistreated by police who are clothed in impunity. And so because he has made it clear that he's at least receptive to the idea that police must be held accountable through the criminal justice system for abuse of power and for mistreatment of the public, the Fraternal Order of Police is trying to get rid of him. Now, does this mean that the Fraternal Order of Police and somebody within the West Valley City Police Department conspired to release this criminal or to botch the case, if you will, in order to create a scandal on the eve of the election? I pose that question to somebody who knows the players very well from decades working within the criminal justice system in Salt Lake City. His name is Edward Flynn. He's a very well-respected trial attorney who knows everybody in the DA's office. And
there's your cliffhanger. We'll be right back.
All right.
You can hear that drum playing, right? Or not?
I do now.
Okay, good. We'll be right back, y'all. Hey, all, Scott here for Liberty.me, the brand new social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features nightly classes, guides, events, publishing, and so much more. Sign up now and you get the first 30 days free. And if you click through the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org or use the promo code Scott when you sign up, you'll save $5 per month for life. That's more than a third off the regular price. And hey, once you sign up, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, guys. So I'm talking with Will Grigg. He wrote the book Liberty in Eclipse. And he writes the blog Pro Libertate at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. And we're talking about this very important article here. Well, let me rewind up to the top. Killer on the loose. Did cops botch a case to punish an independent DA? So, cop kills lady for no good reason. Prosecutor decides he's going to go ahead and look into this and try to prosecute this, but is ended up thwarted by the court. Then the other party, the Fraternal Order of Police, sides with the other political party, in this case the Republicans, and they start backing this other guy against the DA in the upcoming election. And then he's directly in the chain of command for this botched arrest and prosecution of a murderer who, as you say, his accomplices, the murderer's accomplices, and we're not talking about the cop who murdered the lady, we're talking about a separate murderer.
Would be murderer.
The old man survived? I'm sorry.
Yeah, he's in the hospital right now.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry, I had that wrong. Attempted murderer there. But, okay, so the accomplices are in jail, but they let the perp go free, and apparently it wasn't the DA that let him go free so much as it seems as though possibly his opponent in the homicide department deliberately botched the evidence in order to let him go free, and then spin it in the media in the days before the election as all the DA's fault when really his fingerprints are all over the thing. Will Grigg, is that right? Do I understand?
That's one possibility. When I talk with my friend Ed Flynn, he's an attorney there in Salt Lake who knows all the principles. He's of the opinion that Steve Nelson is the head of the violent felonies unit there in the Salt Lake County Police, Salt Lake County DA's office. Ed Flynn is of the opinion that Mr. Rogers is a conscientious attorney, and he doesn't believe that he was the one who botched the case. He believes that, and let me quote him here, either the FOP, that's the Fraternal Order of Police, and the West Valley City Police Department botched this case because they were incompetent, or they botched it because they're corrupt. He says that the cops in the Fraternal Order of Police are slimy, corrupt, and out to get Gill. Gill says he can't charge Marquina, that's the would-be murderer, the suspect in the shooting, on made-up evidence. The West Valley PD knew what they needed to do. They didn't do it. They brought the evidence for the accomplices, but not the would-be murderer, because it makes a bigger headline and a bigger last-minute before-the-election slimy smear on the DA they've decided is not their puppet. So from his perspective, as somebody who knows the principles, knows how the system works in Salt Lake County, and he makes it clear that he's not specifically accusing anybody. He's just reading the evidence from the perspective of a trained observer and somebody familiar with how things operate there, that if this was botched, it was almost certainly botched by the West Valley City Police Department, probably with the active connivance of the Fraternal Order of Police, and that Rogers, for whatever reason, is not directly implicated in screwing up this case. And I think that if you take a look at it from the perspective of who benefits, it would benefit Rogers to see the case screwed up rather than to see the case be successful, because he wouldn't take credit. He couldn't take credit if there were headlines about the arrest indictment.
When you say Rogers, you mean Nelson?
Forgive me. Yeah, Nelson.
Okay,
my fault.
No. There are a lot of names here. I just want to make sure that we're all straight.
I've referred to him as Rogers a couple of times mistakenly. Steve Rogers is the... Steve Nelson is the assistant DA, the 11-year veteran of the district attorney's office. And Steve Nelson is the one who heads the violent felonies unit. And he is the one that Ed Flint, the attorney I interviewed, said is a conscientious trial lawyer. And he doesn't believe that he was directly responsible, but rather that the West Valley City Police Department, which is a thoroughly corrupt agency, more corrupt than most, their newly appointed chief a few months ago became very defensive when a motion was filed on behalf of Daniel Williams' family alleging that, or not alleging, but rather recounting the testimony of a former member of that police department that there had been hush money payoffs to people in the narcotics unit who had been sexually exploiting some of their female informants. The new police chief in West Valley City said, in so many words, well, it's not as if we still have criminals running this department, tacitly acknowledging that it had been operated like a street gang until his advent. Well, I don't think that the institutional momentum has shifted so dramatically in such a short time frame. But from where he stands, knowing the principles, knowing the lay of the land, Flint says that this was botched either as a result of deliberate incompetence or deliberate malfeasance of office, or institutional incompetence, perhaps followed by opportunism on the part of the Fraternal Order of Police. But there's no way that you can look at this and say that Sim Gill is responsible, because if they don't bring the evidence, they cannot indict the guy simply because he wants to. And this is the sort of thing that he, perhaps uniquely among prosecutors in the state of Utah, would scruple at, is the idea that if, as long as we're going to be prosecuting somebody, we have to have something that is, that comports with the habeas corpus requirements and due process.
Now, wait a minute. Is there any argument as to why, I mean, on the other side, as to why, well, we were able to bring the evidence against the three accomplices, but we didn't have the evidence on him? I mean, from arguing the cop's defense that it's not
there. There's no argument that the FOP has made beyond insinuation that this was anything other than a botch, if you will. What they're trying to say is that on the part of the West Valley City Police Department, it was a mistake, but on the part of Sim Gill, somehow this is a deliberate act of nonfeasance of office. That doesn't make any sense at all. And they filed a Public Information Act request for email correspondence within the DA's office that they say would supposedly reveal that there was evidence there and that Gill, for whatever reason, didn't use the evidence to indict the shooter. And what Gill has said is, by all means, file the public information request, because I've got nothing to hide and I'm too busy to worry about this. So this is the sort of thing that will be thrashed out sometime after tomorrow. And the whole point here, as far as I can tell, is that they wanted to create a big splash before a weekend to get everybody in a fine froth of indignation over what happened, knowing that this would do nothing but injure Sim Gill's reelection chances. So at the very best, as far as I can tell, what you have here is probably, and this is the best case scenario from the perspective of the FOP, what you have here is tremendous institutional incompetence on the part of a police agency that is famous for that type of behavior, as well as corruption, that was capitalized upon by the FOP in order to smear Sim Gill. That's the very best case scenario from their perspective. The worst case scenario is that somebody in that police department, probably with the active connivance of the FOP, decided that they'd let this guy go and play catch and release with him, because he's one of the usual suspects. He was well known as an identified member of the Serrano's street gang, and he's the sort of person they can keep on a short tether and then reel in after the election and then probably win another headline for recapturing this guy who was let loose by this alien usurper, this liberal squish of a Democrat DA who's occupying the DA's office there in Salt Lake County. And the partisan dynamic here is really interesting, Scott, because Salt Lake County is the only county in Utah where a Democrat has a pretty good chance of winning office, but typically you don't find that the DA's office is occupied by a Democrat. The FOP endorsed Tim Gill when he ran several years ago, and they became quite disaffected with him because he insisted on holding police accountable to the same laws that they're supposed to enforce. But what Ed tells me is that some of his lifelong Democrat friends who were trial lawyers or just activists are starting to become equivocal about their support for Tim Gill. He needs to come clean about this, they say. Well, he's come clean about it. He said, go ahead, get the records out into the public for public inspection. I've got nothing to hide. If I don't have evidence, I can't charge the guy.
Yeah. Boy, it sounds like you're talking about some third world country where
it really
the police
does.
Union is going to run a DA out of town for daring to try to prosecute a cop who killed some lady.
Exactly. Of all the impudence.
Yep. All right. That's freedominourtime.blogspot.com. Thanks, Will.
You bet. Take care.
Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. Darrenscoffee.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. So, as we were talking about at the beginning of the show, Al Jazeera's got this new documentary out, The Day Israel Attacked America, about the Israeli attack on the USS Liberty in the Mediterranean Sea in 1967. And so on the line, I have Ray McGovern. Ray, you write at consortiumnews.com. You're a former CIA analyst. And now, I know we talked about this, but I forget. You were in the CIA at the time that this happened, correct?
I was, yeah. I was chief of the Soviet Foreign Policy Branch at the time.
Chief of the Soviet Foreign Policy Branch at the time. Wow. Okay, so I guess you had the clearance. So can we start with, well, I don't know. Tell it however you want, I guess, but it'd be nice if you could tell us from your own personal experience at the time what all you knew, what you were being told, what everybody else knew, and based on what. And then we can get into all the later developments.
Sure. Well, I wasn't, in direct receipt the information from the scene of crime, but many of my friends were. I talked with the chief, my counterpart, the chief of the Arab-Israeli desk at the time, a couple of years ago, and I said, what do you recall about knowing how this was done, whether it was a mistake or deliberate, and so forth? He said, Ray, the intercepted message is made clear. We knew that the Israelis did it, that they did it deliberately. We're not quite sure why would they do this kind of thing, but that it was deliberate, there was no doubt. And all our bosses knew that, too. Secretary of State Rusk, Richard Helms, the head of the CIA, Bobby Ray Inman, the head of the NSA, which is on this film, who was on this film. They all knew it. Now, what's the teaching point here for me? There was one of them. Not one of them, Scott, that had the guts to go down to the Times Bureau in Washington or the Washington Post. I mean, both of these newspapers, now people need to realize that these were independent newspapers in 1967, all right? If you gave them documents or if you gave them first testimony, they would check it out, yes. But they wouldn't check with the White House. As they do now, they check it out with other sources, and it would appear within a day or two on their front page. So that's all that was necessary. So when Bobby Ray Inman, the head of NSA, pontificates in this film about, yes, well, a decision was made to absolve the Israelis and accept their apology. Well, hello, where were you, Bobby Ray Inman? You took a solemn oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And
now, Ray, I'm sorry. I got to interrupt you here. I'm having trouble with your audio. Do you know why your audio might be cutting out on us?
I don't, but let me just see if I can get rid of some of this other stuff that I have up.
Okay, yeah, it may be your computer bogging down. I'm sure you must have the bandwidth, but I just hate to have this whole interview kind of...
No problem, yeah. Was it too loud or too soft?
No, your volume's okay. You're cutting out almost like a cell phone cuts out sometimes.
Okay.
I don't know if it's maybe your Wi-Fi or a cable wiggling or what it is.
Well, I've got a lot of stuff off now, so let's see how it goes.
Okay, yeah, it may have been just your computer bogging down. I could see that. Yeah. So, yeah, we'll try to go forward from there.
We can always go to my cell if you need it.
Okay, we can go ahead for now. But so let me ask a follow-up right there, because in the movie, and I'm sorry, I did not get to watch the entire thing. I'm about two-thirds of the way through it. But they talk about how Johnson himself leaked to Newsweek that and said, you know, just call me an unnamed official kind of a thing, and said that, yeah, they did it deliberately, apparently because they thought we were intercepting their transmissions and they wanted to stop that.
Well, you know, there's no accounting for presidents running off at the mouth, and Johnson was notorious for that. What seems not quite fully accurate to me in the film, Scott, by the way, am I coming through clearer now?
Well, you're still cutting out a little, but I'm with it. We'll keep going.
Okay, well, after the break, maybe we'll go to the phone. In any case, we know that from the very start, when the SOS was put out there, the Israelis intercepted it, the SOS from the USS Liberty, and got out of Dodge, right? Those torpedo boats scrammed out of there, back to their home port, and the planes as well. Now, planes were launched from the USS Saratoga and the USS America in the Med and were sent down to do battle with whoever it was that was attacking a U.S. Navy ship called the Liberty, okay? Now, we know that Admiral Geis, who was the head of the 6th Fleet there, was called by McNamara, the Secretary of Defense, and he was told, call those planes back. We don't want them going near that ship. Call them back to land on those air carriers. And Geis, to his great credit, said, I'm sorry, Mr. Secretary, but my naval ship is under attack, and I'll need to speak to your supervisor before I carry out that order. And who is on an adjoining line but Secretary of Defense's Robert McNamara's supervisor? His name was Lyndon Johnson. And he got on the phone and he said, now, Admiral, I want you to call those planes back right away. We don't want to embarrass our ally, Israel. And Geis very reluctantly broke the attack, summoned the planes back to their aircraft carriers. Now, you know the rest of the story. When the ship limped back to port, in Malta, all these people were guarded, were told they couldn't speak to anyone. These naval people, the survivors, after they dug out the body remains from that tomb there where the NSA machines and people were, they were told, you're not allowed to talk to anyone about this, including one another. Your wife, any member of your family, under pain of court-martial. Now, I know some of these guys, okay, and I've talked to them about this, and you want to know a prescription for PTSD, Scott? Well, that's it. That's it. These guys have been suffering since 1967. Only recently have they felt it possible to talk with one another and have gotten together at least annually to see what could be done in terms of righting this terrible wrong. So that's, you know, that was a little bit misleading. It wasn't later that Johnson said, oh, well, I have this choice to make. I need to protect the Israelis because they need money for my reelection. Ironically, of course, he didn't run in 1968. It wasn't that. It was from the very first incident when Johnson himself intervened. I'd never heard of this before. Intervened with the admiral running the 6th Fleet in the Med and said, call those planes back. We don't want to embarrass our ally Israel. That's how bad it was. Other things that haven't come out in the film, it was acknowledged that the Medal of Honor is always given by the president in the Oval Office. but not for Captain McGonagall, not for this heroic captain who had lost lots of blood from a severe gash in his leg, but steered the Liberty back to Malta. Not to him. No, he was, we see the Defense Department little guidance. No press conference here, and it's better if the Department of Defense gives this Medal of Honor. And you know what else? The State Department, before deciding they could go through with giving the Medal of Honor to Captain McGonagall, thought it necessary to call the Israeli embassy and ask if they would take offense if that happened. Can you imagine, Scott?
Well, and as they say in this article, too, and, you know, I wasn't alive back then, but Lyndon Johnson just sounds like Barack Obama to me when they said, well, they threatened that they would accuse him of blood libel. Well, anyone ought to just laugh at that. You know, that one is allowed to accuse anyone who happens to be Jewish of doing anything ever, or else it's blood libel. Give me a break. When it's not even in question, the facts here. I'm sorry we got to take this break. We'll be right back in just 1 second about the coward Lyndon Johnson and the USS Liberty. Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm on the line with Ray McGovern. I think his audio quit cutting out on us. So we're going to keep going with Skype because the audio quality is better as long as it's not cutting out all the time. We're talking about the Israeli attack on the USS Liberty and this new documentary made by Al Jazeera, aljazeera.net, The Day Israel Attacked America. You can find it in my Twitter feed there if you're looking, or on my new Sue page. And now, I'm sorry, let's see where we left off here. Oh, I know what I wanted to talk with you about here. Oh, well, where we left off was the blood libel thing, the political threat to the President of the United States. That you can't say that this was on purpose or we'll accuse you of the blood libel and that'll be the worst thing that ever happened to your political career. Am I wrong to think that that's absolutely ridiculous? The blood libel, for people who aren't aware, is the myth that Jews put little Christian children in their witch's brew or whatever crap left over from the, medieval times, 1,000 years ago or something like that, 1,200 years ago, that any accusation that the Israeli military attacked a ship for a reason would amount to blood libel. I don't think the American people would have taken that seriously at all, would they? Come on.
No, it's a diversionary tactic here. Blood libel is so ridiculous that people will reject it instinctively. What it really involves is money. As long as you can say that this or that thing is anti-Semitic, you seriously endanger your chances of remaining president, of being reelected, or even aspiring to be president. Now, let me give you a very recent example, okay? When the sainted David Petraeus was coming back and he was going to be the head of the CIA, and even that when he was testifying before the Senate Armed Services Committee, his people prepared a statement which said the truth here. It talked about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict fomenting anti-American sentiment and by implication being responsible for the death of U.S. soldiers. Now, when that got out, we have intercepted, we have released emails from David Petraeus, who inadvertently released these to a friend of mine. And what he does immediately, as soon as the press plays this up, Petraeus might be anti-Semitic, he calls Max Boot, who's a charter neocon, and he says, Max, what are we going to do? The date of this is 16 March 2010, so it predates his discrediting later at the hands of the White House later that year. So he says, Max, what do we do? And Max Boot said, no, look, I'll do a little op-ed, and we'll prove to the world that you're not anti-Semitic. And Petraeus says, oh, thanks, Max. Now, Max, Would it help if folks knew that I hosted Elie Wiesel and his wife at our quarters last Sunday night, and that I'll be the speaker for the 65th anniversary of the liberation of the concentration camps in mid-April at the Capitol Dome? Max Boot. No, I don't think that's relevant, because they're really not accusing you of being anti-Semitic. And Petraeus in his email says, Roger! Exclamation point. Smile face. Now, there's a snivelly, there's an obsequious, there is an unprincipled person who will not acknowledge his own written testimony before the Senate because people have started to brand that as anti-Semitic. As I say, he wanted to be president, maybe not that time around, but this time around. It ain't going to happen. Why? Well, as I said before, he got too big for his britches. And I don't just mean Paul of Broadwell or whatever his name was. I mean the White House. He became a threat to the White House. And so Obama and his cronies said, look, General Alexander from the NSA, you get together with
Bob. All right. Ray, we talked about all this on the show yesterday.
Right. Okay.
So let's get back to the Liberty here. We got limited time.
All right.
So, yes, you're right. David Petraeus had to crawl on his belly just like Lyndon Johnson before the almighty Israel lobby instead of just speaking the plain truth, which is apparently anti-Semitic.
Here's something that you might, those who've seen the film know that Sergeant Bryce Lockwood, who was one of the folks that had to dip down inside the tomb there, where I think it was 20 of his NSA folks that were working for him, their bodies and the machinery were, he had a chance to come forward and tell his story, but not until 2006, after Mearsheimer and Waltz had written that very courageous article for the Atlantic magazine called The Israel Lobby. Now, you say Atlantic magazine? No, it was by the Atlantic magazine. But when they saw the text, they held their noses. Oh, we can't publish this. We'll pay anyway, but oh gosh, we can't. So they had to go to the London Review of Books, just like it had to be Al Jazeera earlier this week that did the documentary. London Review of Books. Now, I read that article on my way down to Missouri where Bryce Lockwood lives. And I gave a talk at a church hall. 300 people. And people asked me, what'd you think of Mearsheimer and Waltz article? And I said, I just read it. I think it's great, but there's one anomaly about it that I don't understand. And they said, what is that? I said, they're out to prove how powerful the Israel lobby is, but they don't mention the most vivid example of that. Everybody says, well, what's that? I said, the USS Liberty. Now, well, there are 300 people in that church hall.
Yeah, they all said,
what's
that?
And they all looked at me with blank stares, and I said, how many people know about the USS Liberty? Three people raised their hands. I asked the guy in the front, what does he do? Stands up, ramrod straight, and says, Sergeant Bryce Lockwood, USS Liberty crew, sir. I say, Sergeant Lockwood, would you be prepared to tell what happened that day? Sir, I have not been able to do that just yet, but it's been 40 years now, and I think I'd like to try tonight. And he got up, and for the next 10 minutes, gave a riveting, incredibly poignant account of what he experienced. He was lucky because he was taking the very sensitive equipment to drop overboard. He was beyond the bulwark when torpedo hit. But he dived back in, and he saved two of those folks, one of whom is shown in the film. So what I'm saying here is that not even Stephen Waltz and John Mearsheimer thought that they should adduce the example of the Liberty in this book, or now it's a book, but in this article that was out to prove that the Israelis know, literally, that they get away with her.
I wonder why that is. Have you ever had a chance to ask Mearsheimer that, or Walt?
Yeah, I did. I did talk to Mearsheimer about it, and he said, well, no, you have to, it wasn't a very satisfactory answer. It was like, we had space constraints and we didn't want to overdo it or something like that. So, but, I'm not criticizing them. I mean, they did an incredible service by doing that. And that was a gutsy thing to do. Saying is, even they had these compunctions.
Yeah. All right. Now, so let me ask you about this stuff, because what's supposedly brand new in this documentary, Ray, are these intercepts of the Israelis that we hear. Now, I don't speak Hebrew. I don't suppose you do, or hell, I don't know that. I was wondering if you can speak to the provenance of these, of this audio. Do you know, has there been a debate about their origin and whether those translations are accurate and everything else? Because the story that the clips tell is that they knew it was an American ship all along. They finally call it off on the word that, yeah, it's American, all right, after napalming it, being directed to napalm it, despite that fact. And then even after the planes pull away, they send in the patrol boats, according to the translations put up on the screen in this documentary here. And even then, they send in the patrol the torpedo boats to try to sink the thing that way. And I was just wondering if you can speak to that, if you know people in NSA or if you know where they got these clips from or any of that stuff that can speak to this.
Sure, I can. The tapes themselves were, quote, destroyed, end quote. But there are all kinds of firsthand witnesses. I mentioned the branch chief, who was my colleague at CIA. No doubt, one of the pilots says, but that's an American flag. Like an American ship. Perform your mission. So it was very, very clear. Now, Colonel Pat Lang, who's a friend of mine who has been in veteran intelligence professionals for sanity, he was at Fort Holabird, which used to be the intelligence school that he and I attended. And he was taking a course in which they adduced all the examples of the intercepted communications as a case history of how good NSA could perform its mission. So there's no doubt at all. The only new thing here is to hear actually the Hebrew. Now, I don't know Hebrew, but I hadn't heard, the actual authentic voices. And I have a little reason to believe that they are inauthentic.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I certainly had not heard that they were challenged or anything like that. I just wondered if you knew specifically where they got these. Did they get them from the Americans, or did they get them from an Israeli source, or... do you know if anybody has argued about their origin and really shown yet, or, anything like that? Because I would expect it to come up if there was any doubt, and, it seemed pretty legit to me.
As I say, it's not new except for the actual Hebrew. And, my hat off to Al Jazeera. I don't know how they got them, whether they got them from Tel Aviv, whether they got them from NSA, but they got them. And isn't it a telling thing that this has to appear on Al Jazeera and not on 60 Minutes. Are you still there?
Oh, I'm sorry, Ray. I'm an idiot sitting here talking with the microphone off.
No problem.
I sent a tweet
to... Let me say one more thing if we have a minute.
Oh, sure. Well, I was going to say real quick, I sent a tweet to Richard Silverstein from the Tikkun Olam blog, and I know he reads Hebrew, and I believe that he must probably speak it too. I don't know. But I asked him if he could verify the translations, obviously not the origin of where it came from, but whether the captioning on the screen matches the Hebrew being spoken. And I was, I'm hoping that he can respond to me on that. I was hoping he'd get back to me before the end of this interview. Unfortunately not, but I'm trying to find out anyway.
Yeah, that's a good idea. But as I say, there are lots of tapes. There are lots of conversations here. It wasn't just one pilot to control center. Right, it was a whole bunch of folks. So there's no doubt. It would be nice to follow up, though.
Yeah, sure. Just really because I have the audio now. And so for later, it'd be nice if, I have independent verification of these clips so that I can play them, later on. But anyway.
There were two real heroes in this story that are not brought out. I don't know why in the film. I don't know if we have time to talk about those or not.
You know what? We're already over time, but I'm happy to continue going on because this is such an important story. And most of the listeners are by way of the podcast feed later anyway, Ray. So,
okay.
So I'd be happy to hear the stories.
Yeah. Well, I mentioned Bryce, but, and he's the Marine Sergeant.
Well, you cut out right in the middle of his name there. Try again.
Okay. Bryce Lockwood, LOCKWOOD, lives in Missouri. He's just kind of, it was a very traumatic experience for all of them. But Bryce has been one of the most active in pushing the story and trying to get the American Legion and others to recognize the dilemma that they all found themselves in. Now, he was the fellow that was in the third row that I called on. Did anybody know about the Liberty? And I said, yes, Sergeant Bryce Lockwood, USS Liberty crew, sir, came up and talked about it. Well, later he gave an interview to Tell Somebody, a community radio station with Tom Clammer in Kansas City, and it was incredible, a couple hours. And it was the first time that Bryce felt that he could tell the story, and it was a cathartic experience for him. It was an emotional experience for all of us, because he talked about seeing into that torpedo hole, and two bodies were still alive. He dove in and got one of them, grabbed them as you do when, you know, life-saving Red Cross sort of thing, and then the hatch was closed. He's banging on the hatch. Finally, somebody opens it, and he hoists this one of his comrades up into safety, and he, I believe, is one of the people interviewed in the film. Then he went back for the second one. He grabbed them the same way, and just as he's getting to the hatch, he slipped out through the hole into the Mediterranean in a salty, watery death. That's got to be an experience that any of us will never forget, but that was the one that Sergeant Lockwood experienced with the people under his command. Most of them, well, not most of the Marines, but he was the senior Marine officer. Now, the other fellow, and this is a wonderful story, and I learned about it later, it was a young Texan named Terry Halbardier. I think he was 19 at the time. In any case, he was one of the sailors on this ship. And when the napalm was dropped on the deck, and when the whole place was shut up, and when the antennae were all taken out, the live antennae that the Israelis knew had the capability of transmitting an SOS, Terry Halbardier went to Captain McGonagall and he said, "Sir, you know that antenna that has not been working for this whole voyage? I think I can get it connected. I think we might be able to get an SOS." McGonagall, "Where is it?" "It's over there across the deck." McGonagall, "Don't you know that's full of napalm, man? You can't do that." Terry Halbardier, "I'd like to try." So he goes out there and he plugs the two connectors and they get the SOS out. And that's the only reason why the Israelis were unsuccessful in sinking that ship and killing the entire crew. Now, Halbardier was given the Navy Cross, Silver Cross, I guess it is, in 2009 out there in California, where he lives now, in Visalia, California. When I heard that was happening, I hopped on the next plane, went out, and was privileged to take part in that ceremony. It was May 27th, 2009. I wrote it up for consortiumnews.com, but it was there that in this small office of the U.S. the House representative from that district had him there, and his name was Nunez. He gave him the Silver Cross, and many of his comrades were there, and I was privileged to have lunch with them and to hear their stories. Many of them saying it for the first time, because as I said, they were prohibited from even sharing information with one another. And so Terry Halbardier died just about 3 months ago. And I wrote another article marking that death and recalling all the kinds of things that he did. And, you know, somebody, one of the press said, "Well, did you get hurt?" He pulled up his shirt. His stomach's full of holes, shrapnel all over his body. And I don't know if he did that when he connected the thing or it was done at another time. But so these are...
Well, actually, they said in this doc that he got that shrapnel on his way across the deck to plug the antenna in, as you say.
So there you go. You know, there are real heroes in this whole thing. And when you know about that heroism, how much more... Gosh, how much more angry does an Irishman like me get to think that they were deprived not only of the honor to which they were entitled, But they were deprived of the right to tell their story, for God's sake. They were deprived of the right to be physically and mentally whole as a result of this terrible experience. And so now, with this film out, thanks to Al Jazeera, I hope that Americans can kind of realize, you know, what an albatross this is around all our necks. And things do seem to be moving in the direction of recognizing Netanyahu for being the person that he really is. And I just hope that our president will develop the kind of backbone that will enable him to say, look, Netanyahu, enough, rather than tell one of his little staff to call Netanyahu dirty names, you know. The cowardice here is incredible. And what Obama needs to do is grow up and grow a couple.
Yeah, well, too late for that, man. He's a lame duck now. So if he was ever weak, now he's weaker. When it comes to trying to do the right thing whatsoever, of course, he can do the wrong thing all he wants, no problem. But anyway, I appreciate your time on the show and your dedication to this subject, Ray, because as you say, most people have never even heard of this thing whatsoever. And yeah. They might begin to have a lot different view. I think not just of the America's relationship with the state of Israel, but also the American people's relationship with their government and the media, that, boy, when they're determined on erasing something from history, they get away with it pretty good. I mean, it's not like they can yet, you know, lock you away under the NDAA for even mentioning it, but they can pretty much erase it from any kind of, you know, I don't think there's a college history textbook that would contain it anywhere, right? For example, stuff like that. It's just gone. Yeah. No, I bet you if you ask Dan Rather, he's never freaking heard of it, probably. I don't know.
Yeah, and, you know, another sort of teaching point here, as I see it, is the snivelly kind of obsequious attitude on the part of 4 stars, 3 stars, 2 stars, whether admirals or whether they're generals.
Yeah.
You know, they swear an oath to the Constitution, not to the president, not to their own careers. And when you look at Bobby Ray Inman, for example, now they had him on because he's the most respected senior intelligence ever in this country, okay? He ran the NSA. He had the presence of mind to quit when he was deputy to Bill Casey at CIA. He was regarded as, you know, he actually drafted most of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, the so-called FISA, back in 1978, which put restrictions on NSA's ability to collect on Americans. Now, why do I mention him? I mention him because when it turned out that General Hayden, head of NSA, had trashed the Fourth Amendment just because Cheney told him to and started collecting information on all of us without a warrant and without probable cause, Bobby Ray Inman was invited to a session at the New York Public Library with James Risen, who wrote the story, and a couple other folks. Now, I know somebody was there. Who was there? And what happened? They asked him whether he thought of it. He says, well, Hayden clearly broke the law. I know what the law was. I drafted part of the law. And I even insisted in putting a paragraph in that said, nothing that is not specifically designated here as allowable can be allowed in terms of eavesdropping on Americans. So, sure, he broke the law. Now, that was written up in an obscure blog, but I read it, and I'm thinking about, wow, you know, that's interesting. Here, Bobby Ray Inman is saying that what Hayden did was unlawful. Now, what happens? That very same day, the president, Bush, nominates General Michael Hayden to be head of the CIA for services performed. Okay. Now we're talking May of 2006. Now, bear with me because the story gets even better. On the 4th of May, I had this debate with Rumsfeld in Atlanta and got a lot of media attention. So Lou Dobbs had me up to New York to interview me about, you know, my vendetta against Secretary Rumsfeld. So I'm waiting in Lou Dobbs's office, you know. And that I'm just feeling really good about what I know about what Bobby Ray Inman said about Hayden. And I'm saying, you know, I don't think he's going to be confirmed when people learn about that, you know? And what happens? In rushes Bobby Ray Inman, all disheveled, no tie on for the first time I've ever seen him. And somebody rushes, puts a tie on. And when I was supposed to go into that interview, Bobby Ray Inman goes in instead. And I'm saying, oh, this is good. This is good. Because Hayden has just been nominated to be head of the CIA. If Inman tells the real story about Hayden, he's finished. He can't be head of the CIA, and he shouldn't be. So I'm watching the big screen there, right, waiting for my turn. And Ludov says, well, Admiral Inman, tell me, what do you think? Nomination here of General Hayden to be head of the CIA. And Inman says, you couldn't pick a better person. He's incredibly bright. He's technically proficient. Character, you know, character, no problem. He's full of integrity. He's a wonderful choice. And I'm looking at that. It's kind of, no. So he comes out of the door, you know, and I said, hey, Bobby Ray, what happened? What you said just 10 days ago. And he tucks, he runs. I would have been after him, except I still had 3 minutes left of Lou Dobbs's time, right? So, yes, even the best of them, even the best. Why do I say that? Because Amy Goodman had the videotape of what Admiral Inman had said at the New York Public Library 10 days ago, and she played it that morning. The hearings for his nomination, for Hayden's nomination, were coming up just 3 days hence. And so Bobby Ray Inman got the word, Admiral Inman, you're really screwed up at the New York Public Library. It's bad enough that you said those things. Amy Goodman played them this morning. We carved out a few minutes for you at Lou Dobbs. You go and make restitution and do it now. Right. And so. So there's a story about the snivelly relationship between four stars, three stars, and I could go on because there are lots of examples. Petraeus is one, and General Zinni, the well-respected Marine general who sat there and listened to Dick Cheney tell lie after lie about WMD in Iraq on the 26th of August, 2002. He should have spoken up because he knew they were lies. He waited 3.5 years to do that. So these guys really should be held accountable just like everybody else.
And that's the great Ray McGovern, everybody. 27 years as a CIA analyst. Now he's a peacenik. He goes around speaking against war for Tell the Word, and he writes mostly at consortiumnews.com. You can also find him at raymcgovern.com. And that's three in a row there. Find him in the archives at scotthorton.org/interviews. And we're overtime. See you tomorrow. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org.